Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and this week I'm joined by Ian Leslie to talk about cutting human error in the NHS. George Eaton, Tim Wigmore and Lucy Fisher talk about the collapse of the Lib Dems and of the BNP. And I talk to Ian Steadman about whether we should call it climate change or global warming. It's been a big week for political nerds, so I'm joined by a bumper crop of analysts. George Eaton, editor of The Staggers, Tim Wigmore, who is joining us to write some articles about politics over the summer, and Lucy Fisher, who is the Tony Howard scholar. So hello, everyone. And I'll start with you first, Tim. You wrote a piece for us about the collapse of the BNP. So Nick Griffin lost his seat. The other BNP MEP had since left the party already.
Yeah.
And the vote share they picked up was pitiful. What happened?
Well, I think Their success was largely due to them exploiting a deep-seated anger amongst especially working class people in Britain, and a sense of that the political class would be
this kind of idea of left behind,
out of
right?
touch. Yeah. And so many of those have gone to Nigel Farage and his party now. And I think also that the BNP, I mean, Nick Griffin is a leader. He managed to alienate pretty much everybody. He just insulted people. His appearance on Question Time 5 years ago was a complete disaster. And I just think ultimately people did not want to. Many of those who supported them were holding their noses as they voted for them.
And one of the things I think is really interesting, and George, perhaps you can answer this, is whether or not, is it too simple to say all those BNP voters just went to UKIP?
In part, some of them have stopped voting, some have gone to Conservatives, some have gone to the English Democrats, or the various other bizarre splinter Eurosceptic parties on the ballot paper. But I think Farage recognises that. Griffin certainly recognises that they've been hurt by UKIP. Interestingly, one of the points that Griffin makes is that if you really want to stop immigration, then don't vote for UKIP, because they've said they want to stop immigration from the EU by pulling out, so stop the free movement of labour. But they've said they want lots of Pakistanis and Indians to come over, and these skilled workers, and we don't want them. We're against any kind of immigration. And that's an interesting tension, in that you can see UKIP is making an attempt, actually. I mean, there was a very interesting line from one of their strategists who said that they want to detoxify the issue of immigration by saying, you know, we are in favour of immigration, but good immigration, not bad immigration, which is all of these Eastern European
that
scroungers.
That slightly reminds me of kind of Chris Morris and good
exactly.
AIDS and bad AIDS, isn't it? It's a slightly, but I agree with you, that's definitely a metaphor that's used. And Lucy, when you were at The Observer in your previous placement, you interviewed quite a lot of black and Asian UKIP voters and candidates. How successful have they been at downplaying the sort of constant attack they get that they're a racist party?
I don't think it's been a very sophisticated strategy they've pulled out. Personally, I find it very uncomfortable being dragged around by a press officer pointing out someone saying, look, you know, here's a black person, here's a gay person, you know, they're in our party. See, we're not homophobic, we're not racist. That doesn't sit terribly well with me. In terms of the Croydon Festival last week, I mean, what an unmitigated disaster.
And so for anyone who doesn't know, this is when they hired a steel band and essentially tried to put on a street carnival, mm-hmm. which descended into chaos, and Nigel Farage didn't end up going.
Yep, he was around the corner in a car, but speedily drove off when the steel band refused to play, finding out that it was a UKIP event. So I don't think they're really winning over ethnic minorities at all.
And George, is this, I mean, some of this, you get a lot of people, particularly on Twitter, saying this is the media's fault, that UKIP is a media creation. Do you think that's true? And if so, do you think that the media fascination with UKIP is now, we're kind of done with it, we're on to the big election now, we want to talk about the, you know, parties that might have a chance of governing?
I think it helps them at the margins, but I think this line that some seem to be pushing, that UKIP's a creation of the BBC, is quite a dangerous one. That UKIP has been around for a long time. So it began as a breakaway from the Conservative Party in protest at the Maastricht Treaty and the creation of the EU. And then it really came to prominence when it finished second in the European elections in 2004 and 2009. I think the reason it's gained so much since is because immigration has risen in salience as the number of migrants has dramatically increased. The Lib Dems no longer function as a protest party because they joined the government.
Oh, well, it's funny you mention the Lib Dems, because let's take a moment to dwell on their misfortune. Not in a nasty way, but this has been the big story of the week. So they performed really pitifully in both the European and the local elections, losing, 150 seats at local level, slipping to fifth place in some places around the country. Seems sixth place, I think, in Wales. And then there's been a kind of series of poorly executed manoeuvres against Nick Clegg. Where are we with that now? Does he look safe now?
Well, he's certainly in a safer position than he was after the European elections, largely due to the ineptitude of his enemies. So Lord Oakeshott was clearly naive in thinking that he could leak, or someone could leak those polls on his behalf, and that they wouldn't be able to be traced back to him. I mean, it was clear, everyone said, well, who doesn't like Nick Clegg? Who is wealthy enough to fund these polls, and who is constantly briefing off the record? You know, all lines trace back to Oakeshott. I think he's safe because there isn't a Heseltine-style figure that the rebels have coalesced around. There's no one who's prepared to challenge him rather than merely taking over once he's resigned. I think the majority of MPs support him, and that's mainly because I don't think it's certain that the benefits of deposing Clegg would outweigh the costs, which is exactly the reason why Labour, for instance, pulled back from getting rid of Brown, because they feared something even worse.
I wonder if another thing with the party is that they're just so small physically in Westminster that if you hear a Lib Dem source, you don't need to be too smart to work out who that probably is. And the fact also that almost a third of them are ministers, of some sort, which means, you know, lots of people on the payroll, lots of them have been in government at some point, which means lots of people sort of, I think, as personally loyal to Clegg, because he's the one who's got them a ministerial position or a cabinet position at some point, and he's the one who's given them a pay rise in that sense.
But I guess so the million-dollar question for me is whether or not, I think we probably all accept that Nick Clegg is safe. What are the Lib Dems safe? What are the reasons now? How are they going to bat in the next election about why you should vote Lib Dem?
I think it's...
Go for it.
I think it's certain that their vote share of 23% in 2010 would probably be halved or so in 2015. But the big question is, as you said, whether they can, in the seats in which they're incumbent, whether they can use the sort of the power of the popularity of their local MPs, and more than that, the sort of... There's almost an incumbency that's divorced from the specific MP, as we saw in Eastleigh, despite Chris Hoon obviously triggering that election there. The popularity of the local council meant that people were very loyal to the brand of the party. So a big test, that will really be the test, is whether people are loyal to their local, the Lib Dems on a local micro level, and whether they think that because their local Lib Dem councillors are good, their local MP works very hard, but that's more important than Nick Clegg breaking various promises.
I think you're right to say the incumbency sort of factor is a really big question. Personally, I feel that, in fact, the Lib Dems are really unfortunate to be losing so many big players next year. Don Foster, Heath, Bruce, Min Campbell, all stepping down, and all really sort of important people for the central Liberal Democrats. So on that side, on one side, we've got the incumbency problem. But I also think, while I agree with George and Tim that the leadership challenge against Nick Clegg is over in the immediate sense, it's been a really mucky affair. And the fact that we have had two MPs, John Pugh and Adrian Sanders, come out against him, or at least sort of stirring up tension along with Oakeshott, other PPCs in Winchester, in West Dorset, you know, sort of saying he's got to go, I think that will harm the party. It just looks very mucky. The public won't like that. I think it does damage the image of the Lib Dems.
Well, it's a very fast-moving story, so who knows, by the time we come back next week, Danny Alexander could have been made king of the Lib Dems. So we'll leave it on that note, and I say thank you to George, Tim and Lucy. I'm joined by the writer Ian Leslie, who's written for the magazine this week about one man's personal mission to end human error in the NHS. Hello, Ian.
Hello, Helen.
So tell me the story of this man, his name is Martin Bromley. What made him kind of look into the idea about how he could prevent errors in the NHS?
Well, what provoked his long campaign is that something really terrible happened to him, or more specifically to his wife Elaine. A doctor's made a mistake which led to essentially to his wife's death. So his wife went in for a very, this is about sort of 7 or 8 years ago, his wife went in for a fairly routine operation on her sinuses. She'd been having really kind of severe sinus problems for a few years.
So essentially she lost the ability to breathe, her windpipe collapsed, and then they spent all this time trying desperately over and over to intubate her rather than going straight to tracheostomy, just cutting a hole in her windpipe. And I thought this was really striking, as one of the things you bring out is the fact that there were people in the room, there was a nurse in the room who brought the set over, didn't she? She brought the tracheostomy set over to the doctors and they ignored them because they were so intent on just trying to intubate her.
Yeah, so you had these three very experienced doctors, combined experience of about 60 years between them, who became fixated on trying to perform this technical operation of intubation. And the patient was being starved of oxygen. And the people that could see that this was a massive, urgent problem were the people on the edges of the room, like the nurses, who came in and, without explicitly saying so, hinted that maybe this was a problem, that something needed to be done about it. And the doctors just looked at them like, you know, what are you talking about? And by the time the doctors realized that what was going on, it was too late.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
And then you link this in the article with the fact that Martin Bromley was a pilot, and every pilot, when they're studying in school, am I going to say in pilot school? I'm sure there's a proper name for it, but they study air crashes, because exactly the same thing can happen in a crash situation, right?
Yeah. So when Bromley kind of got over the awful shot of this, he started thinking about it, and he started looking at it. He made sure that a report, an investigation was carried out. And when he looked at the report that was submitted, everything became slightly familiar to him. He realised what had happened because he'd seen it, exactly the same kind of mistake being made by pilots in accounts of airline crashes. Because in the airline industry, every crash is studied in detail. So when you go to pilot school, when you're trained as a pilot, You really spend a lot of time looking at airline crashes and understanding why experienced pilots make those kind of errors. So when Bromley looked at this report of these doctors, he was like, oh, I see what's going on here. This was fixation error. I recognise that. People getting technical operation and losing sight of the bigger picture.
And you talk in the piece about this strange kind of dilation of time that happens in a situation like this. So people just simply don't realise. You talk about, I think it's flight 173 is this famous example where they're running out of fuel and they're so fixated on getting the landing gear down that no one apart from the engineer, the very junior guy, says, you know, we haven't got enough fuel to make it to the airport. So yeah. What can be done? Because in all these situations, the idea that comes up is one of the problems here is hierarchy. It's a kind of people being invested with authority and then they're not challenged. So how do you break that problem?
Well, first of all, people have to be aware of it. People have to be made aware that when you're under a lot of stress and an emergency situation, it's incredibly high stress, then you're going to make mistakes. It doesn't matter how experienced you are, how smart you are, how good you are at your job. When you're under that kind of stress, you will make these kind of mistakes. That's the first thing to get people to recognize. And the second thing is to get everyone to realize that the more people that feel empowered to speak up and say, hey, look, you know, this is going wrong, we need to sort this out, the less likely it is that these mistakes will happen. So the guys at the top, the surgeons or the pilots need to understand that, but also the people, the crew or the nurses need to understand that they need to speak up when they see something going wrong.
One of the things that I found most striking in your article is this idea about the fact that a problem that, like the one that affected Martin Bromley's wife, happens in 1 in 20,000 operations, which they consider a remote possibility. And then he says in the aviation industry, that would be, you know, that would be, we're really worried because planes are falling out of the sky all the time.
Yeah, pretty much. They have very different perception of risk in the airline industry. I can't remember the stats off the top of my head, but yeah, if they treated risk in the same way as the NHS thinks about risk, then you would see a lot more crashes. If you can imagine the airline industry, if there was a crash every day, just saying, oh, well, you know, this is just the way things are, you know, these things happen. That's the kind of the equivalent of what the NHS is doing at the moment. So there's a real disjuncture between the way these two kind of industries think about risk.
And then I think the lovely way that you bring this through to the conclusion is by talking about the clinical human factors group. So yeah, would you just tell us a bit about what that is and what that does?
So Bromley, who, you know, as we've said, was an outsider to the NHS, has ended up making a big difference to the way the NHS thinks and behaves. In the wake of what happened, he set up this group, which became the Clinical Human Factors Group. Which campaigns for better understanding of these issues and for changes in practice and behaviour in the NHS, it seeks to bring insight from the airline industry, but also from other safety critical industries like nuclear power industry, the rail industry, where they think about these things a lot, to help the NHS get better at thinking about and dealing with mistakes. You know, trying to make sure there are fewer mistakes, but also mitigating the effect of mistakes when they happen.
I was really surprised at how simple some of these things are. So you talk about the idea of just using a marker pen to mark the surgery site and then, you know, the surgeon signing it. And that reduces the astonishingly high number of times that they accidentally take out the wrong kidney or amputate the wrong leg or all those kind of things.
Yeah, wrong site surgery. It happens way too often. And yeah, making sure there's a marker pen there means that the surgeon is much more likely to do it and not to just to leave that bit out, and therefore less likely to make a mistake. Yeah, they're incredibly mundane, these things, and that's partly what's prevented them from being practiced. Like checklists, you know, having a checklist of things that you must do in this operation, and that the whole team at the beginning of before the operation goes through this checklist. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 things. Here's who's responsible for what. These are the things we must do. Just introducing that has reduced accidents and mistakes by a huge amount, just as it did in the airline industry. But because these things are so mundane and not very kind of cool and sexy, a lot of surgeons aren't interested in them. And so it's been a kind of long campaign on the part of Bromley and his colleagues to change the culture of the NHS.
Well, if people are interested in reading more, you've written one of our longer features we published this year, actually. It's a really beautiful in-depth piece. And they can, even if they want even more from you, they can read your book, which is called Curious and which is out now. Thank you very much, Ian.
Thank you very much, Helen.
I'm joined by a science and technology writer, Ian Steadman, to talk about climate change, or is it global warming?
Exactly. There are, well, two kind of main ways that people talk about the way the climate is changing. Climate change is a term that's been used for decades, even before the science was really settled on human-caused climate change. But in the 1980s, as it sort of became obvious that we were sort of destroying the planet by filling it up with filling the atmosphere with carbon dioxide and other sort of greenhouse gases, the popular term was global warming. And that's still like the more popular term compared to climate change. And that's because it is kind of gets across what's happening, which is that year on year, the average trend is that the Earth's surface temperature is going up. But
you get people burbling about mini ice ages and about sea ice and stuff like that, don't
you? Yeah, because there are knock-on effects of that, which mean that in the short term, like the weather that we experience actually kind of might contradict that feeling. And this is something that a lot of climate scientists struggle with, because there's this trade-off between communicating science effectively and sort of being accurate and stuff, but also wanting to influence political policy and public opinion. And this study came out from the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication, which is a project at Yale where they specifically deal with studies in how to make sure people understand what climate change is and what's happening. And they pretty much just went around asking people about very identical questions about, do you believe in global warming or climate change? And they would just change the term climate change or global warming each time. And they found that people were way more scared by the term global warming than climate change. But that's the less accurate term, which kind of raises questions about science communication.
Because presumably they thought that climate change sounded neutral. I mean, you know, things change. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad.
Yeah, and you get people as a result saying stuff like, ugh, whatever happened about climate global warming, when they see it's raining outside in May like it is at the moment. But they found some like really fascinating results. Asking the question, do you think global warming or do you think climate change is a bad thing or a good thing? Global warming was seen as a good thing compared to climate, was seen, sorry, global warming was seen by a 12-point difference in responses as a better thing than climate change. No, I said that the wrong way around, didn't I? Yeah. They asked the question, do you think global warming or do you think climate change is a bad thing or a good thing? And by a 12-point difference, people said that climate change was better than global warming. And there was a 13-point difference in the other direction where they thought it was a bad thing. So there's this dramatic difference that is expressed in results.
This comes up all the time, doesn't it, in science communication? Because, I mean, I think you had the similar row, for example, over Brian Cox's series Wonders of the Universe about the idea of, is it dumbing the stuff down?
Yeah.
And his defence was very simple. You know, I'm making a BBC One programme that's going out, whatever, to 8 p.m. It's the kind of thing I want a smart 10-year-old, 12-year-old to watch. If you've got a degree in physics, then yes, you'll know the stuff already, but equally well, I'm not making the programme for you. But that comes up all the time. I think it's a really vexed subject, particularly for science and scientists and their engagement with the media, because they know that the media is traditionally, let's be fair, pretty bad with numbers. We're very bad at reporting sample sizes, for example. We're very bad at reporting the difference between correlation and causation. We love using words like something is linked to something else, which is so vague as, you know, get you laughed out of town in a peer-reviewed journal. But I guess the bigger question here is about framing.
Yes, yeah.
So can you think of other examples where how the framing of words affects how we think about them?
Well, the study itself contains a really interesting anecdote. There's this guy called Frank Luntz, who was a pollster for the Republican Party during the midterm elections in 2002 under George W. Bush. And he sent this memo around to the Republican Party saying we should call it climate change and not global warming, because we know that climate change doesn't sound serious. We have polling that shows this. So I think politicians have been very clear, obviously known this for a long time. And you can kind of see that in the rhetoric from both sides. When people talk about climate change, they might be seeking to downplay the risks. When people talk about global warming, to make it seem more serious. But you also get that in terms of things like the bedroom tax, which the coalition government is adamant is the spare room subsidy being removed. Whereas, you know, the Labour Party is, it's the bedroom tax because people are losing money. And it technically isn't a tax, but a tax sounds worse. So,
and you had the whole debate about the death tax and death panels. And this idea of death panels, which is essentially, I mean, you know, that has to happen at some point in a health service. Somebody has to decide what level you will fund end of life, at what level you will fund an experimental cancer treatment, so on. But if you call it a death panel, suddenly it begins to sound pretty spooky.
Yes, indeed. Another example I found was actually from an episode of The Simpsons. This is the one where Lisa's the president in the future and Milhouse is her advisor. And instead of they have to raise taxes because the country's broke, and instead of calling it a tax increase, they call it a temporary refund adjustment, which I think is quite a nice little joke about this kind of wordplay.
Well, that's kind of what Gordon Brown used to do when he never used to talk about spending. He always used to talk about investment.
Yes.
So I guess that we should probably all pay a bit more attention to the words that politicians use, and maybe that scientists use as well, because obviously you can very much affect how people feel about a policy or about a phenomenon like climate change / global warming by how you talk about it.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Ian. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons, and our producer is Philip Morn.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.